This podcast is brought to you by DKP & Co. Chartered Accountants. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Nick Debano, and it's great to have your company this evening. Big program to get through. Asian Champions League results. We'll recap that later on in the program and also go through our Manchester Derby preview in the second half of the show. Joining us in the studio is football historian Ian Sisson. Ian, it's great to have you back with us again.
Yes, I'm starting to do this quite often, aren't I?
Yeah, it's great. Are you enjoying it?
Yes, I do. I like coming in. It's a great place.
Anzac Day is tomorrow, and we know it marks the landing of Australian and New Zealand forces in Gallipoli. It's also evolved to a day where we recognise and acknowledge and appreciate the services and sacrifices of all Australians who served in the war. But bringing it back into the context of football, we have a little bit of a dilemma.
We do. We have a massive dilemma because we need to work out our own place in relation to the whole Anzac story. And a lot of my work has been about trying to establish the extent to which soccer was or association football was a game that was heavily involved in the in recruitment, enlistment and service in the armed forces, and also, you know, deaths in service of soccer players. And I have, I think, to my satisfaction at least, established that soccer was indeed a very big part of the AIF in the First World War. Now, having established that, what do we do then? Do we say, hey, let us play too. Let us be part of Anzac Day commemorations. What do we do? And it's a dilemma for me, because I think if we try too hard, if we're strenuous in our attempts to be part of it, we'll look like we're coming off as slightly exploitative, not respecting the tradition. So what do we do as a game? And it's a difficult one. I mean, what do you think?
It's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Because we've seen in a lot of other codes in the game, particularly AFL, they've built that up to be a traditional Anzac Day clash, Essendon against Collingwood.
Yeah.
Whereas in the A-League, we don't really have that.
No.
Are we trying to create that kind of identity? Should we be able to create that identity? Should any sporting code in the country be able to play on Anzac Day? Or should we completely leave it as a day of reflection and remembrance?
Well, yes, it is a difficult one. I mean, my personal opinion is that it's gone too far. I've been published in the newspaper, in The Age, as having said that the way Anzac sport is played out doesn't actually respect properly what Anzac Day could be or should be. And again, that's a really hard, you know, thing to work out. What should Anzac Day be? But I don't think the way it's celebrated in both the NRL and the ARL, sorry, the AFL, I don't think it's done quite properly. But, you know, there'll be other people who have very different opinions from mine. But I think that it's, I mean, I'd be happy just to turn the lights off and ask everyone to go home in terms of Anzac. But that's not the reality. The reality is we have a competitive sports marketplace where every sport is trying to obtain the best advantage and leverage, to use that phrase, that term, leverage events, moments for their own benefit. And, you know, AFL have actually done that. They've leveraged Anzac Day to turn it into a massive event. And what do we do? Do we just sit there and go, okay, that's theirs. They can do this, and we'll just sit on the sidelines and be respectful? Or do we do something similar? I mean, I think that... Again, you know, I think the listeners about to hear the uncertainty, indecisiveness in my position. But I think that if we could actually find the ashes, you know, just to remind everybody, we're looking for the soccer ashes. If we could find the ashes and have a game against New Zealand on Anzac Day, then the whole, all of the terms of Anzac Day, of Anzac, would be brought together, and it would be, you know, it wouldn't be for massive publicity or massive gain for the local league. It would just be a respectful acknowledgement that our game was at Gallipoli, our game was part of the armed forces, and soccer players were killed during the war, and we need to remember those people as well.
And it'd be symbolic of that.
Yeah.
If we did reignite that tradition.
Yeah, that's right. So
it's only fitting.
Yeah, it would be fitting, and it wouldn't be part of the expansionist aims of any league. It would be just part of what we do as a nation and what we've done for, you know, what we used to do for many, many decades as a nation, which was play New Zealand regularly. But, you know, again, you know, David Gallop last week suggested, you could hear the way he was talking, he suggested that that was going to be very difficult given our international commitments, you know, with other teams, with other nations.
I think that's very interesting because we talk about Anzac Day games being almost here in Australia. There actually is a game tomorrow, and it's almost like there's been not that same build or marketing and advertising about Brisbane Roar versus Adelaide on Anzac Day. It's just almost been advertised as another game in particular. When you compare that to the advertising, what you see for the AFL and the NRL, I know you were saying about, like, you see stuff about Anzac Day Eve now and almost taking that leverage at the AFL have sort of looked to use that. And there was no such thing as Anzac Day Eve, before 3 or 4 years ago. And now all of a sudden it's a marquee game the AFL have sort of utilised in that way. It's baffling in a way, very strange.
What do you do on Anzac Day Eve? What do we do traditionally? I know what we do on Christmas Eve. Mm. You know, we kind of...
It's just another day, isn't
it? We get nervous children off to bed and that sort of stuff, excited children off to bed. And, you know, there's a sort of pattern of in our, those of us who follow Christmas, there's a pattern in our lives. But what do we do Anzac Eve? is it a thing?
It's really just another day.
Yeah. But, you know, now we know that the AFL has Melbourne Richmond, Anzac Eve.
It's weird, isn't it? Mm. Now thinking about it, I don't think we should play anything on Anzac Day.
Well, it's not a bad argument.
Like, why are we actually playing on Anzac Day?
In any sport.
Yeah. I think that
why do we need to play? Let's be realistic. The A-League does not need to play tomorrow.
No, well, it's a Thursday.
We never play on a Thursday. The last time we played on a Thursday...
We played Thursday night last week.
And
but that was,
just about to explain why, because Sydney FC have the extra fixture with the Asian Champions League. So they had to then go off to China to play against their opposition in the Asian Champions League. But that's the only reason why we did play on a Thursday. But so there's actually no reason why the A-League should be playing on a Thursday, just for the sake of it. Is probably not good enough.
But does that change at all? I'd love to get your points on this as well, your opinions on this. If, say, that it fell on a Saturday, which it will, I believe, next year, I think that it does take that, obviously, because of the leap year. Yeah. Do games, do you think, should still go ahead? Because obviously Saturday, Sunday, Friday are the traditional time slots, or for most codes, the AFL, NRL and A-League will more than likely fall on that weekend. Do you think that changes anything, or in terms of it not being during the week?
Well, I don't think it should change anything. I think you should play if Anzac Day falls on a Saturday or a Sunday. You should just play the fixtures as you've planned. It's going to be interesting to see what the AFL do. Do they stop everybody else playing? If it's a Saturday?
I know that a few years ago when it fell, they used to play 2 or 3 games on the one day, and it was almost, they had the game they played in New Zealand for 2 years as well to sort of broaden that Australia-New Zealand part of Anzac, but that was sort of fell flat after about 2 years. So it is an interesting dilemma what they will do, because that's usually 5 games in one day.
Yeah.
I really like the idea of what you've previously suggested and what we've already spoken about on FNR is reigniting the Australian v New Zealand clash and competing for the Ashes, because that to me makes more sense than having an A-League game on Anzac Day. Yeah. Okay, David Gallop did mention that it might be hard to organise that, but I think with appropriate planning, even if it's not our Socceroos and Matildas, it could still be our youth national teams.
Yeah.
There's no reason why that can't be organised.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that people are going to say, "Well, what's the angle here? What's our market penetration with this?" They're going to all those sorts of questions, and the answer is, "Well, not much." we're not going to have much market penetration. We're just going to have the game celebrate internally.
We'll bring back history that once was.
Yeah, and
surely that's good enough.
That's good enough for me, but is it good enough for the practical numbers people? You know, the people who say, well, you know, why aren't we leveraging? And I think that's the problem, and that's the dilemma that we raise when we try to talk about what should soccer do on Anzac Day, and that's the how much does the hard-headed business kind of thinking have to do with what we do?
And I was reading some of your book.
Oh, terrific! What's it called? The game that never happened.
The game that never happened. Where can people buy this?
They can buy it from the publisher. And they can also get it at Readings Bookshop in Carlton.
Okay.
As well, yeah.
There you go. Go and pick it up.
Yep.
And in there you wrote, I'll quote this, a team mostly of Victorian soldiers playing soccer and beating a team of English soldiers in France during the First World War must surely be a rarity. Sporting contests between Australian troops and their allies blossomed in all theatres of war for purposes of morale, fitness and recreation.
Yeah. So the thing about soccer in the armed forces is that there's two things to think about. One is that soccer wasn't as marginal as people imagine. It was quite a popular game pre-war, and a lot of the soldiers were soccer players. But also, when they wanted to play games of sport against allies, where were most of the allies from? They were from England. And what did most of the English soldiers want to play? Soccer.
Mm.
And Australians put their hands up and said, okay, we'll play this game. We'll have a go. And so a lot of men who hadn't played the game before got involved in these competitions. And so there were soccer games being played all over France, all over England, and involving Australians. And it's like, and some of these people were shifted. Some of these people, I need to do more research on this, but I've seen cases where men who'd never played the game before played in the armed forces and came back to Australia and took up the game. So it was a big deal in the armed forces during the war, and there's plenty of diaries that reveal the extent to which soccer was being played. Often a diary will talk about, it'll be an officer's diary, talk about a week's events, and they will list what happened. They did, they did this march, they went here, they went there, they played a game of Australian rules, they played a game of rugby, and they played a game of soccer. And it was almost like each game had its own place. None was more important than the other. And I think that's what we need to emphasise when we talk about the history of sport in the Australian Armed Forces. Soccer wasn't the dominant game, but it certainly wasn't the minority game either. It was just a part of the whole fabric of the Australian Armed Forces.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable when you think about it. And obviously it really does say it in the title, like the game that never happened, because it is never mentioned.
Yeah,
we have something that brings it to light and allow for the broader football community to know that it was there in an important time in not just Australian history but world history as well.
Yeah, obviously I don't mean soccer never happened. Soccer did, and as I've said a number of times, not only did it happened probably more often than most other codes of football.
Mm.
But it doesn't happen in terms of memory. It doesn't happen in terms of mythology, in terms of legend. Who are the great? What are the great soccer legends from before World War II?
While you were compiling this book, what story in particular sticks out in your mind
from
World War One or World War Two?
Well, I mean, the one that I've been focused on lately is the Irimpel story, which is the one, the team in Mildura, that was basically the starting point of my research, where I found this tiny team in a tiny town that lost all those players. But there are other teams. There are other teams that lost lots of players. There's a team in Melbourne, the Thistle team. They lost eight. Eight of their members were killed in the war. The Caledonians in Perth lost eight. And it's like, it's just astounding. You see these lists compiled in the newspapers of soccer teams and the number of players they sent and the number of players who were killed. It's just, it makes you wonder how the game could even restart. Lost so many good players. And a lot of the players that went were injured, were wounded, and came back, shadows of their former selves, and they weren't able to play to any extent the way they used to be able to.
How did the game move on from there?
Well, it started off slowly, lots of enthusiasm because sport was seen as a way to normalise society quickly. So everybody got back into sport. The government was kind of encouraging this kind of behaviour, and everybody got right into it. And soccer developed because we needed more people, and so more migrants came. Waves of migrants came in the early 20s, and by the mid-20s, soccer's become a really dominant force again around Australia. And then the fateful year of 1927 happened, which basically the game shot itself in the foot, but that's a kind of another story.
Yeah, it's quite unbelievable, obviously, as you said, shot itself in the foot, because you think 1920s, you think league would come into it, something that obviously broadened, and then obviously took so long after that until we actually saw some sort of Australian Soccer League or Australian Cup, I believe it was, around the 50s.
It's in 1927, remarkable things were happening. Clubs were leaving soccer and going to rugby league up north. They stopped playing soccer and started playing rugby league. Wallsend did that. A team in Ipswich did that. And you know, the game was very strong in those mining communities. And for internal politics reasons, people were saying, "I've had enough of this. We're going to a different code." And you know, that's also has an interesting aspect to it, because it makes you think, well, hang on, aren't they very different games? But I think it makes you reflect on how different and perhaps how harder soccer was as a game back in those days, and how it was closer to rugby in terms of the physical contact and so on. But that's another story as well.
Yeah, exactly, because I guess obviously the same day they're all still somewhat in the same family, but that is interesting, like obviously the contact differences and everything else, like making that jump, like, because it's very rare that we even see it now where players would make the jump, like from soccer in particular. You see it from rugby to AFL, but very rare to see soccer to rugby, rugby to soccer now.
You do actually. I mean, I grew up in Queensland, so I did actually see a lot of people move from soccer to rugby league, kids. And one of the stories that I talk about is often Aboriginal kids that I played with were fabulous players, and there was a certain sort of cultural expectation that they moved to rugby league as they got into their teens, and also the money that they were being offered, even at very local club levels. So there actually is movement between the codes. I don't know if you know of Andrew Johns, who was a rugby league player.
Yeah.
He was a very good soccer player when he was a kid, and he had to make a choice. Preston Campbell, an Indigenous rugby league player, he also played soccer and loved it.
I believe Brad Green was on trial at Manchester United as well.
And he was offered a gig at Walsall and he knocked it back. Adam Goods was a great soccer player. And he shifted as well. So there actually is a lot of movement from soccer to the other codes. There's not so much movement the other way, I think, because I think, as we know, soccer is a game that requires those 10,000 hours of ridiculous repetitions of passing with the ball with the side of the foot and trapping and controlling hard kicks with your feet, and it doesn't have the requirements of other codes, but it's very hard to shift to from something like Australian rules to soccer. And another part of the book where I write the epilogue, where I talk about that game where Jack Dyer, the Richmond coach, bagged the soccer players in the 60s, and so basically they challenged him to a game, and the Slavia team demolished a team of AFL players, soccer, of VFL players at the time. But again, that's another story. Read the book.
That's exactly right. Go and buy it now. And Ian, before we wrap up, what is a lasting thought or maybe a comment that you'd like people to know about? Or even it could be something that you would do differently on Anzac Day.
I won't do anything differently on Anzac Day, I guess.
In terms of the sporting code as a whole, football, what would you like to see happen around this time of the year?
Well, like I said, not a lot, but I would like people to reflect, however they reflect on Anzac Day. Everybody's different in the attitude they have towards it. But I would actually ask people to just have a little think about, you know, where are the soccer stories in relation to Anzac, and why don't we know any when, you know, so many soccer players were on the first landing, so many soccer players died in the first week. Why don't we know that? And I think if you start to answer that question for yourself, you start to unpick a very big history, a very important history.
Fascinating. Yeah. And finally, how's the search going for the ashes?
Oh, well, it's I'm doing phone interviews with people who might know, and we're struggling, but I'm going to keep at it, and hopefully we'll get some leads soon. We've got some leads, but we hope to get some strong leads soon.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining us in the studio and on Evenings on FNR. We're going to take a quick break, but plenty more still to come.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
You're with Louise Taffer and Nick Dibano. It's great to have your company this evening. Remember, you can get involved at any time by giving us a call on 03 99 44 99 99, or you can tweet to us at FNR_radio, or if you are joining us on Facebook Live, comment below.
We have had someone come through on the Facebook Club. We have Jim say that there's been massive news about NCIP today. Now, I saw a tweet just a little bit earlier once, you know, I saw his comment come through, to go back on and get it. He tweeted towards Joseph Carozzi about NCIP and about if there's any update on the NCIP review. And Joseph Carozzi said, and I quote in a tweet, "The NCIP has been scrapped. It was decided at a board meeting, and in its place, it's a principles-based approach which promotes inclusive and non-discriminatory clubs. We're developing the principles now, but NCIP is no more." So it's over. So we don't know exactly what the wording of the new policy is at the moment. We'll find out a little bit more. I believe that because then Jim came back in the comments and asked him, for example, if an extremely inclusive club in the fourth division of Northern New South Wales, aka Hamilton Azzurri, has a small Italian flag on the jersey. We know at Avondale, one of the teams, and Hamilton, one of the teams that copped it for that matter of having it and had to cover it up. Is that not inclusive? Is this discriminatory? Just looking for a practical example. And then Joseph responded, "Without jumping the gun, I think it would be okay as it reflects history." So it looks like we're going to see no more hiding of traditional flags, and it's back to the way it should be, and no more of that, which is fantastic news.
It is fantastic news, and I thought we scrapped NCIP like 2 months ago, though.
I think it was just a confirmation about what we're to now. So this was all happening today on the Twitter sphere within the last few hours, and good to see that this has gone through. But Louise, we must talk about things that are happening on the field, and last night there were two big games.
There were indeed. In the Asian Champions League, Melbourne Victory were in action, as were Sydney FC, and both actually got a draw. Melbourne Victory were going into the game and they didn't really have anything to play for because they were had no
points. They were all but out.
That's exactly right. But they ended up getting a point in the 1-1 draw with Guangzhou Evergrande.
Poor giveaway by Brown. Immediately to the feet of Paulinho. Getting to the byline. Clever cutback. And there is the opening goal. Huang Bowen finishes it off 24 minutes in. And you can't give away the ball in your defensive third like Corey Brown did there. That was a slip from Anderson Talisca. Big chance here. The equaliser immediately from Jai Ingham, the Asian Champions League specialist.
With thanks to Fox Sports, yes, Melbourne Victory coming away with a 1-1 draw. And Jai Ingham, we haven't seen him all season, and yet really? He pops up and scores that goal.
Well, Jai Ingham's only played 4 games in the A-League this season, 4 appearances off the bench, and he had his 1 appearance in the Asian Champions League, and he's got a goal to go with it. He, as Brenton Speed said in the call, he is becoming a bit of an Asian Champions League specialist. It seems like he scores every season in it against the big opposition. And they went down very quickly. They were able to respond, and that was brilliant that they were able to do that, because you look at this Melbourne Victory team on paper, it was nowhere near full strength. No Toivonen, no Honda. Droisi was out. Costa Barbarous was another one that missed. Raul Baena as well. The defence was basically almost full strength. Broxy as well didn't play, and the bench was full of 18-year-olds. There was the likes of Aaron Anderson, Benjamin Carrigan, Jack Palazzolo, and Tiel Iradikunda. I think I'm saying that correctly. And Jack Palazzolo got a couple minutes off the bench.
His debut.
Yep, and Anthony Lesiotis and Ramin Ekbari as well got cameos. But I think that victory showed a lot more than what they have all tournament in one game where they were basically playing a second-string team and had nothing to play for. I thought it was absolutely remarkable. And to be honest, it's not like they played brilliantly because, in all fairness, Guangzhou were the better team. I think we can't deny that. They have all-star players all around, the likes of Talisca and Paulinho and even Tyus Browning in defence. They've got a fantastic team and they had the support. Incredibly enough, there were more Guangzhou fans than there were Melbourne Victory supporters on the night. It was unbelievable. It was like it was a Guangzhou home game on the road. And I think that this now for Melbourne Victory, look, it's expected, obviously, that they're going to go. Obviously, they're out now. There's nothing really for them to play for. But they want to take something out of these last two games, maybe get a win out of those. But I thought last night they had a good chance to do it. Kenny was in on goal at the end. And
just so unfortunate to miss and not even get that shot.
It would have been lovely to see Kenny Athew get on the score sheet. It would have been lovely to see the victory come away with the win. But Guangzhou, they're a fantastic team. We must not forget that. They are arguably the best team in China. They are right now second in the group. Sanfrecce Hiroshima did beat Daegu yesterday.
And they're taking on Sanfrecce in their next Asian Champions League match.
Which isn't, I believe, for a couple of weeks. I believe that game
8th
will
of May.
Be... Yeah, sorry, 2 weeks' time. That should be wedged in between two finals. So if the victory do get past that first final, which will more than likely be a Melbourne derby, and interesting to see what the fixturing happens with that. Obviously, no Marvel Stadium is all booked out. They'll have to travel to Korea in between a potential first elimination final and a semi-final if they get the win. So they could be going from Melbourne to Korea. If they win, they'll have to then come back and play in Sydney. Because if they do obviously win, it is guaranteed they'll play Sydney FC in that game. So,
and it's also in the AFC regulations that you have to field a non-reserve team. You have to field a...
That was as close as to the absolute like benchmark or like the absolute limits you could push in terms of the team you could put out there because they had literally...
Lawrence Thomas in goal. Maybe that was the difference maker as well.
Well, Thomas maybe having as well, Thomas Deng, having those guys, Donicky, Antonis, they're sort of your first stringers, but everyone else is sort of guys you've been seeing come off the bench regularly. Obviously, Corey Brown, Storm Roof played a lot of games this year, as is Cal Valeri, but Josh Hope, Joe Ingham, Elvis Cam Sober, and Kenny Athew have been rotation players who have played a lot of 20-minute cameos, half an hour cameos off the bench with the rare start.
Six under-23s in the squad, both either starting or getting minutes off the bench. Hope he got 80 minutes under his belt, which he has struggled to get game time all season.
Been in and out a lot.
Must be really quite frustrating.
Yeah. I have to wonder where the future lies for him next season, whether he'll still be at the Melbourne Victory. I believe he's contracted next season, if I'm correct.
And even just
that.
Some of the other players, what happens to this Victory squad?
Well, I think that Jai Ingham is out of contract, and I said that he should have an Asian Champions League only contract if the Victory are there next season, because it seems like that's his specialty. I think that he'll more than likely be off next season. I think that there'll be a few others that will follow. I don't know what Kenny Athew's future is. I don't know how long his contract is, or how long. Obviously, Carl Valeri is retiring. That Lee Broxham, we don't know what he's doing next year. Keisuke Honda's out the door. Toivonen's still got another year to run. James Troisi has been subject to plenty of rumours to move to other A-League clubs. So a lot of question marks over who comes in, who goes out. But I assume some of these guys will be on the outer. The other side that were in action last night, though, Louise, was Sydney FC, and they were absolutely fantastic last night, I must say. We're in the lead. They fell back. We were able to pick a point from this one. Let's listen to the goals on that one from their game with Shanghai.
Cleverly done. Zhang Wei to flow to back post. It's 2-1. It's Wang Shanqiao who stole it unmarked. And Shanghai SIPG have come from behind within 15 minutes of the restart. Here's De Jong. Would you believe it? It's 2-2. It's Adam Lafondre with a glancing header. This game is just raining goals. And the Englishman has his second in the Champions League. And we're back square again.
Thanks to Fox Sports for that bit of audio there. Sydney FC 2, Shanghai SIPG 2. Not bad result, I must say, on the road for Sydney FC. Deferring fortunes in comparison to the Melbourne Victory. They're still right in the thick of things. They've only lost one game out of four, but three draws. And you'd have to think that that win's got to come somewhere because they're getting closer and closer every week. And to take it to a team like Shanghai SIPG, they were fantastic again last night.
And they're only 2 points off Shanghai in Group H. So Group H is really all to play for at the moment, and Sydney FC still a chance to progress to the knockout stages, which is what Sydney FC's head coach Steve Croker really wants, and he actually believes his side can do so. So if the Sky Blues can continue their form in Asia, who knows where they might end up, but I think it'll be on for young and old when they take on the group leaders, Ulsan Hyundai, in their next
match. And that's also potentially ahead of that big blue. It will be ahead of that home final that Sydney will have in the second week of the finals before they take on Kawasaki in their last game, who are currently third. Three draws equal to one win, but they would love to have at least had one of those games go in their favour, in particular that home tie against Shanghai SIPG. I think they'd be still kicking themselves they didn't get the win from that one.
Oh, they should have gotten that. To me, is not good enough.
Nah, poor defending as well.
They switched off because they thought they had it wrapped up. Little did they know that you can't do that at the top level.
When you've got Hulk and Alkerson and Oscar, you know, you can't do that.
You can't do that. Nah. You can't switch off for 1 second, no matter if it's 1 minute to go or 10 minutes to go. Unfortunately, they paid the price for that and lost an extra 2 points, which they could have had three.
Well, interesting about this game was I found that Sydney FC they almost had a full strength lineup out there, obviously without Michael Zullo, who didn't play in left back. They had Paolo Retro filling in. I thought Ryan Grant was absolutely superb once again, but I feel like they really improved once Daniel De Silva came onto the field and added that extra bit of dimension. I think that he's a real X factor for Sydney FC, something that we haven't seen much of due to injuries. Well, he's been his best when he's been at Perth and Central Coast previously. He has shown a lot, and I think I want to see more of that. So I'm interested to see whether he'll get more minutes in the in this little run towards the finals, because even though you've got De Jong, Lafondra, Reza, these guys who are just absolute guns, even Alex Brosk as well, you think that Danny De Silva's just that ace up your sleeve you can throw on in a game like that, and just someone who's willing to take the game on, I think, is one thing I love about him, because there's not many of those players in the A-League who I've seen actually willing to drop the shoulder, run at players, create options for other players. De Silva does that, and he's still young. He's, about 20, 21 years old, and he was on the Roma's books for a bit. I don't know if he's still technically part of it. He's actually been bought out by the Mariners. I believe he's actually still owned by Central Coast as part of that loan system deal.
He's the only player in the A-League, or one of the only players in the A-League that is actually utilising the A-League
and completely exploited
system.
It.
And it's great to see that he's able to, you know, maximise his opportunity at Sydney FC. Of course, he's not allowed to play against the Central Coast Mariners, your parent club, which is an interesting clause, but that discussion for another day. In other Asian Champions League matches, Milos Deganek's Al Hilal actually won 1-0. So they are still at the top of the table, which is exciting for them.
Yeah.
It's because they're in Group C.
They've got an all-star team really
going
there. They do. They really do.
But great to see one of our Socceroos doing well. And Nick, it's interesting because we touched on the fact that there's an A-League game tomorrow night.
Wow, I honestly had no idea there's a game tomorrow. I had no idea until the other day when I looked at the fixture. I'm like, there's a game on Anzac Day at 2 p.m. Like
Brisbane against Adelaide.
If you want to schedule a game on a Thursday night or Thursday in general, wouldn't you think going toe-to-toe with the Anzac Day sporting fixture that's been the constant for almost 25 years in the AFL's Collingwood-Essendon game, going head-to-head with that is a little bit strange. I know it hasn't been marketed as an Anzac Day fixture, but wouldn't you think Thursday night would have made sense? But look, there is a game. We must obviously keep with that. But Matt will be Matt McKay's final game. He will be obviously getting a bit of a farewell. In that one, we know Enrique as well announced that he will be finishing up at Brisbane Roar, and they've got a whole range of injuries, and they've got some big returns. Devere, Pepper, and Botiak all in the team. Could be Eric Botiak's final game for Brisbane Roar as well. There are rumours saying that he could be off to the Melbourne Victory next season, and Adelaide's got a pretty big in as well.
They do. Baba Diawara returns
about
from
time.
Injury. And we also see that Nathan Konstantopoulos has been promoted. Carlo Amiento has been promoted, as has Apostolos Stamatopoulos, who returns from suspension.
And the last game he played, he had probably one of the more eventful halves. He scored 2 goals and then got a red card. So these two, I'll tell you what, they had a classic the last time they met. I believe it was, 4-3 or 5-4. There were red cards everywhere in that game. It was actually was 4-3 back in round 17. And it was one of the more incredible A-League games you'll ever see. So this is going to be, I think, look, for Brisbane, they've got nothing to play for at the moment. They were smacked last week, 6-1 at home. It was disgraceful, in my opinion.
Well, look, I think when you put it into context, you know, it's...
You would have wanted to see a little bit more, though.
No, but they threw in half a dozen young players that have not had any A-League experience all season.
But
so
you don't want to be losing 6-1. That's the thing.
You don't, but I guess this is what the end of the season is for, in the eyes of some coaches, to get a few minutes into some of the young players who don't normally get minutes in the A-League, and that was the result, 6-1 to the Newcastle Jets.
Well, Robbie Fowler as well will be watching on. He's been announced as the Brisbane Roar manager. He'll be watching on keenly to see who sticks around next year. There'll be some players playing for contracts. Some of the young guys will want to put themselves in the frame to be part of them next year. Adelaide, though, they've won four on the bounce. They've won three of their last four. They haven't, obviously, there was a draw in between there. They win tomorrow and they seal a home final, which will more than likely be against the Wellington Phoenix, which I think is a mouthwatering fixture to say the least. But we'll make that Wellington-Perth Glory game a dead rubber. Barring Melbourne City absolutely come out and smack Central Coast Mariners on Friday night and make it a little bit interesting, that there could be a bit of goal difference coming into play. But I just think that in this game, Adelaide are going to come away with the chocolates.
Yes, I do agree with that. Adelaide United, in my eyes, will take the 3 points. I think that whatever happens with Brisbane Roar, it could be a similar story where Davies just fields, you know, a whole heap of young players. Unless he wants to really upset the apple cart and chuck in a more experienced team.
Wants to play spoiler.
Well, why not? Last A-League game for the season. Why not play devil's advocate?
Exactly right. That would make things really, really interesting if they played devil's advocate and did play spoiler at Adelaide, just to make things a little bit interesting heading into the final couple of days.
Because it is quite tight.
Well, Louise, we advertise this, and we don't really get much of a chance to talk European stuff, but we have our opportunity. There is a massive game tomorrow morning. You look at the permutations of the English Premier League at the moment. You look at the table. This is arguably the biggest game of the season. Probably one of the biggest EPL games, because there hasn't been a title race this close since 2012, when it was these two teams battling it out right to the final day. It's the Manchester Derby. It's Manchester City versus Manchester United. This is the game in hand that has been spoken about, that Liverpool fans have been waiting for. We want to see that game in hand, and this is it. If Manchester United win, it puts their rivals, Liverpool, forefront of winning what will be their first Premier League title in almost 29 years.
I'm fully aware of that.
But if Manchester City win, Liverpool are back on the back foot, and if Manchester United win, they're still in the top four calculation. So this could really go either way, but it's been a bit of an uneasy week for Manchester United. They were smacked on the weekend. You weren't happy at all. I could tell right now, you were frustrated.
It's embarrassing. It's not frustration. It's just embarrassing. The fact that Manchester United lost 4-0 to Everton is a joke. And something has really got to change, because it's not the manager. It's the playing squad. Now, there are at least 10 to 15 players who should be on their way out the door.
10 to 15 players. You're wielding the axe.
I would keep probably three.
Three players? Which three players would you keep?
I would keep De Gea, I would keep Rashford, and I would keep Pogba.
Not Martial.
But Pogba will definitely leave at the end of the season. I can't see him staying around. And I'm not including all of the young academy graduates, because I think they're quite fine. But our defence is shocking. Absolutely shocking. Smalling, Jones, Young. Get rid of them. Get rid of them, because it's not good enough. It really is not good enough. You see and you watch teams like Liverpool, Manchester City, the players die for every blade of grass. They are sprinting for the ball. They're not dropping their heads. They're not walking back. It's an attitude thing. It's just not there for Manchester United. And it hasn't been for years now. Where is the next EPL title going to come from? Because it's not going to come out of thin air.
It's not.
It's
not.
It's an absolute joke. And now the 178th Manchester Derby is right on the doorstep tomorrow morning. We're in a very interesting predicament, because who do we help if we win? If we win, we hand the EPL title to Liverpool. If we draw, we potentially
hand it to Liverpool.
Hand it to Liverpool, but also
if you win,
miss out.
If you lose, sorry.
If we lose, miss out on UEFA Champions League spot.
Europa League will be set, but that's not really
anything not good enough
for Manchester
Top
United.
Top four has to be the aim.
Touching on those players that have to leave, I do follow those same sentiments. I think this Manchester United team is way below par. I think that the way the players they've got don't necessarily mould to the Manchester United they should be. Now, obviously, under Alex Ferguson, they had a team with some absolute stars, but they had a team that Alex Ferguson knew how to get the best out of a bunch that weren't world beaters. He had guys in there that, as you said, played their hearts out, were just put everything in on the line. There, as you look at this team right now, I've got the squad up at the moment. David De Gea, for me, he stays. Victor Lindelof and Eric Bailly, still young guys. I'd keep them around. Phil Jones, he's got to go. Alexis Sanchez, I think that the experiment has failed big time. He's got to go. Juan Mata's getting a little bit older. I love how he goes about it, but I think he's got to move on as well. I'd make the big call in getting rid of Romelu Lukaku. I genuinely think that this has not been the move they would have wanted for from him.
A shadow of himself. We see him starring for Belgium, but it's not the same
here. I think that they need to build their attack around Marcus Rashford and Anthony Martial heading into the future. I think they're the two guys they really need to keep going with. I think Chris Smalling and Phil Jones said need to both go. Jesse Lingard, I think, is a great squad player, as is Fred. Diego Dalot, even Luke Shaw and Scott McTominay. But everyone else, they need to have a bit of a clean out. I think that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer needs to look at bringing in some big players. I'd be looking at Matty De Ligt. I'd be looking at guys as well like Luka Jovic.
Well, De Ligt, don't even bring De Ligt into the conversation. He's going to Barcelona.
But you have to
why
be,
would he want to go to Manchester
ambitious
United?
Because Manchester United have the war chest.
And that's
the
problem. That is the problem. Exactly what I'm saying. Why would De Ligt want to go to Manchester United?
If Manchester United made Champions League, there is that pull. And there is a pull of playing for Manchester United.
Used to be. But why would you want to go to Manchester United when you can go to Barcelona? I wouldn't.
At the same time, though.
No player does these days. And that's the issue. Because what once was a haven for players, if you were offered a contract at Manchester United, you would go. But now it's not. The pool just isn't there anymore, I don't think.
But at the same time, though, you have to at least put your feet in the water, at least try.
But
if you
also
put the offer out there,
especially given our rivals like Liverpool and Manchester City are growing each year, where Manchester United isn't keeping up. They're falling behind domestically and in Europe,
and it's
just simply not good enough.
I know they say Ole's at the wheel and all this stuff about Manchester United being, you know, having that great win over PSG, they had those few wins early on. But I think now they're just starting to get worked out. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not a proven manager. I think that's one thing we must remember. Before Manchester United, it's not like he coached another amazing team to great success. He was coach of Molde. When he was at Cardiff City a few years ago, they got relegated. A time now for Manchester United to really look at this squad and potentially just go through a rejuvenation phase where they can bring in some new guys, get rid of that deadwood who have been there and potentially overstayed their welcome, and give some of those young guys those opportunities. I'll look at the likes of Timothy Chong and Mason Greenwood as two guys that they could really push to be part of that team next year. Axel Towansby from Aston Villa as well, and Timothy Fosu-Mensah should be part of that squad next year. Relying on Phil Jones and Chris Smalling, who have been there since 2010, even longer, over 10 years and extending their contracts, it's a stopgap measure. It's not a measure that you want to be putting in place to look to go to the future. I know I always talk about AC Milan, but they're a team, they're in a similar position to Manchester United at the moment. They haven't had the same success. They haven't really been part of it. But they've got a young base of players they're bringing through. Donnarumma, Calabria, Romagnoli, these guys are all young players. They've said, all right, we're going to build your base around you. We're going to give you guys that push. With Manchester United, they've got this bunch of guys that just aren't at that level. They're guys that aren't starters for Manchester United. For me, they should be going to teams that maybe are that rung down. They're Europa League starters, but you want to be competing in the Champions League. You got
to
bring in some big players.
You do want to be competing in the Champions League, and now the only way we can do that is top four.
Well, if they win tomorrow, they will put themselves above Arsenal, depending on their result with Wolves. They've got another massive game. Wolves have been a bit of the team that has. They've sent some shockwaves through the EPL. They went big in the off-season. They brought in some big players. But the Gunners, if they get a win tomorrow, they will put themselves into fourth, leapfrogging Chelsea, and it'll make things very difficult. But I think a loss for Manchester United, and we'll be saying curtains to their hopes of playing Champions League football. But we must talk about literally what this means in this game. Because if Manchester City win, it puts Liverpool in a position where they can't do anything more about it. Because they've had, in my opinion, almost a perfect season. If they get max points, they've had a better season than the Invincibles of 2004, but still might not win the league.
No, and maybe that's what they have to say, that we've done the best that we can throughout the season and we'll just try again next year.
At the same time, though, it would be an absolute kick in the guts because they have done everything right this year. And you look at their last three games and they're probably going to get maximum points. Huddersfield at home, Newcastle on the road, Wolves at home. I can't see them losing any of those games. This is the only game I could see Manchester City dropping points as well, because they play Burnley away, Leicester at home. The only other potential banana skin, and this is talking absolute extremes, is Brighton. And for only one reason, the relegation factor, that if it comes to the final day and Brighton are battling with Cardiff or Southampton to stay up, that they're going to be desperate and it is at home. So it does make things intriguing, but I just can't see if Man City don't lose tomorrow or don't draw, it doesn't come a draw, I just can't see Liverpool winning the league if that is the case. This is the game that Liverpool fans will be getting a little bit, will be getting very nervous about. And I guess
they
the saving grace
nervous.
At the end of the day, they're still in the Champions League as well. So if they
well,
would have
then. That's the other thing.
And they've got to balance that too, because that's going to be big against Barcelona. So
I don't think, in my eyes, Liverpool will win the title. I think
I think
Manchester City will do it, because the only other competition that City are in at the moment is the FA Cup.
And that's not for a while. Don't have to worry about that final for, I think it ends. The final is after match day 38 of the season. So when the season's done and they've potentially wrapped up the league, they can then focus on that.
But Liverpool have the extra competition of the UEFA Champions League, and we know who they're up against next. And it's not going to be an easy task, because I think the first game is actually away.
It is. It is away. And to be honest, that actually bodes well for Liverpool, in my opinion, because you get that away leg out of the way early, and then you focus on playing Newcastle after that. And then you, in between that game against Wolves, you're at home. You don't have to worry about the travel factor of going overseas, or not really overseas, but it's the right wording, because they don't really, anyways, overseas, go to a different country. But
this is overseas.
Yeah, this is
England
very,
to Spain. They're not the
still,
same country.
It's close enough. But anyways, look at this game, and I look at just how Liverpool could do it, and I think that it's just going to come down to this. I just can't see Man City dropping points anywhere else. And I said, I did an article on the FNR website last week with, I predicted how it was going to end, and I said this was going to be the game that Man City were going to drop, and they were going to draw this game. But I said that before Everton had gone out and smashed Manchester United at Goodison Park. So there's this, all different permutations from this game, which we've got to weigh up. But you never know. Manchester United might come out tomorrow
Could
and just
a
get
a
scrappy 1-1 draw or a 0-0 and just might just go, we're going to play really pragmatic football, take the point. Because if Manchester United get the point, they'll be a point behind potentially Arsenal.
Then
they'll
play
still in the
Chelsea
hunt.
Next.
And that's another
by
massive game.
Huddersfield. Huddersfield are already relegated.
Yep, so their season's
and then
done.
Cardiff City, which is another pretty straightforward game. But
yeah, exactly
then again,
right.
Manchester United always seem to.
And then Cardiff could be battling for survival on that day as well. So it makes things very interesting. Oh, look at this fixture. The next game after that's actually against Perth Glory. So for Manchester United, it's going to be, I think it's going to be one of the more interesting games, because anything can happen. I think that because these are Manchester derby, it throws up that thing. It doesn't matter where you are on the table, that literally a point from this game will be massive. And you think Liverpool supporters will eat that bit of humble pie and say, we're actually going to wear the other red today. We're going to be donning Manchester United jerseys and be almost like de facto fans just for the day, just to hope that Man City drop. Just all it has to be is 1 point. Like, it just literally, a 1-1 draw will be enough. A 0-0, a boring 0-0.
A number of Liverpool players have actually come out and said that they're supporting Manchester United.
I don't blame them. But
a number of Manchester United fans have come out and said, we're supporting you, Manchester City. We heard from Kyle Walker. He was walking down the streets in England, and some of the Manchester United fans were coming up to him saying, yeah, we support you, because we'd rather hand you the title than Liverpool. And that just shows the desperation. Now, I've also heard from other Manchester United fans, and they're praying that Liverpool lose one of these next games.
But the thing is that could very well happen. I said I don't see them losing points, but we've seen, and I don't want to scare Liverpool fans, but we've seen it happen in the past where they've dropped points in games they shouldn't. This is a very different Liverpool team, but anything could happen. Like, who would have thought in 2014 that Crystal Palace would have won that game against Liverpool when they were 2-0 down? Like, Newcastle could come out there. It's at St. James's Park, and they could get an upset. Nuno Espirito Santo's Wolves have been amazing all season. I don't expect much from Huddersfield. Well, they haven't been amazing, but they've been better than what probably most people thought, especially considering they've just been promoted. So, anything could happen.
Well, because he did his due diligence. He brought in a team and signed decent players.
And also, we must remember about Wolves is that they could potentially, depending on how the FA Cup and obviously where teams finish in terms of how the Carabao Cup spots all filter out, they could finish 7th or 8th, want to be competing for that and get Europa League football next season. So there's so many different little intricacies of things that could happen there.
Fascinating.
This game is massive. But there were games this morning as well, Louise. There were two very important games, one in particular for Tottenham Hotspur. They got a late win against Brighton, put Brighton really under some pressure now in the relegation battle. Christian Eriksen scoring with 2 minutes to go to get the win. And Tottenham, they have all, in my opinion, I think that they're almost there. They're 4 points inside, but I think they're going to get that top four position. And in my opinion, a big tick considering their season as well, being in a Champions League semi-final.
Yeah, I can see them pretty much sealing up that third spot on the EPL table. As for Brighton, just 3 points above the drop zone, it's not looking good because when you look at their next fixtures, Matty Ryan, it's not going to get any easier. You've got Newcastle and then you've got Manchester City later on and Arsenal.
They're going to have to win that game against Newcastle. It's almost a non-negotiable because if Cardiff get a win somewhere, they're going to be really under the pump.
But it's amazing how just in the space of a month, things can change so dramatically.
Exactly.
Because we weren't even talking about Brighton being in the drop zone. You know, they were a little bit further up, sitting around 12th, and now they've just plummeted down. We already know that Aaron Moy is going to be relegated. Whether or not he actually is going to go down with the sinking ship or stay up in the EPL and be signed by another club is another discussion. But I don't want to see Matty Ryan go down either.
No, no.
But then again, same kind of story.
Well, Brighton
could he be signed by another EPL club and stay in the top flight if Brighton does go down?
He definitely will. Whether it's a promoted team or whether it's a team that already do need a goalkeeper, I think that he'll be playing Premier League or maybe in another big league. We saw he's at Valencia not long ago as one of their goalkeepers. Wasn't playing too much, but he was still on their books. But Brighton have won a game in six. That's six games in a row, 1 point coming against Wolves last week.
And it seemed to take a bit of a turn after the Asian Cup. When he came back from the Asian Cup.
It was they got that win against Brighton in the FA Cup quarterfinals. And ever since then, losses against Southampton and Cardiff are part of those. They had a 5-0 drubbing at home against Bournemouth as well. They lost 3-0 against Chelsea. And they're going to have to beat Newcastle if they want to stay up. I think that's the game which is going to be the difference maker. Because Cardiff, they have a very winnable game against Fulham on the road, who are already relegated, before a game against Crystal Palace at home, which I think they could very well win at least one of those games and make things very interesting. But for Southampton, they are edging closer towards safety, and they scored a goal within the first 7 seconds, the quickest ever Premier League goal from Shane Long. Unbelievable, but they were cancelled out late by an Andre Gray equaliser, which got Watford an important win as they look to get one step closer to seventh, and which, depending on whether they win the FA Cup, they could very well be in the Europa League next season, which is a big tick for the Hornets, who have been fantastic this season.
Big tick. I'm looking at the time. We don't have much time left. Anything else on the EPL before I move on?
No, that's everything. I believe that is all, and we'll see what happens tomorrow.
Perfect. An amazing stat came across my desk this morning. I just can't believe this. Ajax have scored 160 goals in all competitions this season.
Jeez.
That is incredible. That has never been 160 in all competitions for 2018-19. That's never been achieved by any other Dutch side.
That is absolutely unbelievable. I'm just getting their stats up right now to have a look at some of their top goal scorers and some of the other stats. So
now, when you look at, comparing,
22 goals from Dusan Tadic, 15 from Huntelaar Ziyech, 11 from Kasper Dolberg, not including 8 goals from Van de Beek and Neres as well. That is unbelievable. Absolutely
160
incredible.
Goals in all competitions. Now, when you look at Liverpool, they've scored 79 this season.
In just the Prem or in all competitions?
Just in the Prem.
They would have gotten close. I reckon they would eclipse the 100 through Carabao Cup. They went out early in the Carabao and FA Cup, but their Champions League campaign, they've scored a lot of goals too. So pretty close. But Ajax, unbelievable statistics. And
it is.
They could very well win a Champions League. That's going to only get increase.
I am predicting a, as we've discussed,
Barcelona-Ajax final.
Barca-Ajax final. Who do you think
it is? Ajax, yeah.
I think it's
Barca-Ajax final, I just think Barca are going to be too strong, but I'd love to see it happen. I want to see Ajax in the final. Some other big games tomorrow morning, just to quickly note, there is a Coppa Italia semi-final leg two between AC Milan and Lazio. 0-0 in the first leg. This is at the San Siro. They played each other the other week, and it was quite a hot-tempered affair. Now, I don't know if you saw this one, Louise, but Milan won the game 1-0, and there was a little bit of backwards and forwards on social media between Lazio defender Francesco Acerbi and Milan midfielder Timo Bakayoko. Acerbi came out in Italian media and said basically that Lazio were going to win. They were the superior team. And Bakayoko said, well, let's just wait till the weekend. Milan got the win, and it was at the Sun Siro, so they swapped jerseys at the end. And Timo Bakayoko and Frank Kessie, two of Milan's midfielders, had a Cherubis jersey and went over to the Milan fans and held it up, a Cherubis jersey, almost as like a war prize, like literally saying, yeah, like, we've just stamped our ground. And the Lazio players were livid. Simone Inzaghi, the coach, before that was sent off. It was a very hot-tempered game as well, because there was a penalty given away. Ciro Immobile came out on social media, wasn't happy. Same with Acerbi. And a lot of the Italian media has been saying, well, they're playing each other in a couple of weeks. This game's going to be hot-tempered. And they played each other as well in the Coppa Italia semis last year in the same manner. Ended 0-0 over the two legs, went to penalties, and Milan beat Lazio in a penalty shootout. Incredibly. So this game, if you want to watch a hot-tempered affair at the same time, you want to double screen this somehow. I know.
What time?
It's at 4:45 as well, so it will be at the same time as the Manchester Derby. Hot-tempered affair this is going to be. I'll be up watching this one, no question about it.
I want multi-view on.
Yeah, well, this game's on, obviously on Rai Italia, so all the nonni out there will definitely have this one ready to go. But this is going to be a really good game, and hopefully my boys Milan can get the win there. In a bit of a logjam at the moment for fourth place in Serie A. The other semi-final between Atalanta and Fiorentina is taking place on Friday, and that first leg ended 3-3. So that goes to show, very attacking on that end. But this is going to be hot-tempered. I can't wait for it. And if you want to just, as I said, you want to see a big game of football, that is going to be it.
And just staying in Italy for the moment, we also saw that Juventus finally wrapped up the Serie A title for...
Yeah, no surprise.
And eighth consecutive time?
Eighth consecutive. Last team to do it was Milan back in 2011. But since then, no one's been able to do it. There's been actually record... Listen, so there were two seasons in a row where Roma and Napoli got record points, like for a team that usually wins, like that amount of points usually win you the league, yet they still couldn't win it. Because Juve's points were just that far ahead. They're 20 points ahead of second place Napoli. The gap is widening, and for me personally, as a big advocate for Italian football, it is concerning because of the way that all these teams in the end all crashed out of European football. So hopefully next season we could see some of these teams start to bridge the gap a little bit, because I think that the quality is there, but it's just not being tapped into. And hopefully a Milan or a Napoli or an Inter can just start to just slowly close it a little bit with Juventus, because it's starting to become a constant every season. Juventus are winning the league, and we want to see a little bit of variety. So hopefully we can see that change.
All for that. And in Ligue 1, Kylian Mbappe scored a hat-trick as PSG wrapped up their respective domestic title in France with a 3-1 win over Monaco on Sunday.
The last team also to win the Ligue 1 was Monaco as well.
Two also quick stats before we wrap up. One, did you know that the 20-year-old, Kylian Mbappe, has actually scored more goals than six Ligue 1 teams this season?
Let me guess.
He's scored...
Guignamp, Cannes, Dijon, Amiens, and probably Toulouse. That's probably about it.
Nice, Guingamp, Cannes, Dijon, Amiens, and Toulouse.
Guingamp,
yes.
That's the one. Nice only scored 23 goals this season. That's
incredible.
Unbelievable. We've only conceded 30. So
Mbappe individually scored 30 goals this season.
Well, PSG have scored 95 in Ligue 1 this season. It's been unbelievable. And Lille, Lyon, Saint-Etienne, and Marseille, and Montpellier will battle it all out to get those final few spots in the Champions League and Europa League.
And the last one, who is the most decorated football player in history?
David Beckham?
No.
Pelé? Maradona? Ronaldo?
Dani Alves.
Dani Alves.
He boasts a ridiculous 42 trophies.
Wow. Unbelievable.
To put it in context, Messi only has 34.
Unbelievable. He's played for Juve, Barca, PSG. He's played all over the place as well, with a few international trophies as well, Brazil. Quick little stat before we wrap up as well. Quick little just also for La Liga fans out there. Atletico versus Valencia tomorrow. Big game as well. Valencia looking to get back inside the top four. So this is going to be a really, really solid contest.
And also congratulations to PAOK for finally
being
crowned.
The Greeks out there, 34 years
34
in the making. They
years.
Did it. Good stuff, PAOK.
Incredible. Thank you for your company,
no worries,
Nick.
Always.
Thank you for your company at home. If you missed any of the show, head to FNR's website or FNR's SoundCloud. We'll see you again at the same time tomorrow evening. Bye for now.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.